Today on Vox Talks Economics, coalitions of the willing. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Graduate Institute in Geneva. My name's Tim Phillips. We're at the first Hoffman CEPR Recipe Conference, where we've been talking about policies for sustainability, the climate transition, and restoring nature. Now, they're all things that demand international cooperation, and you might have noticed there's not a lot of that about at the moment. So how do we move forward? Well, this is also the subject of the third Paris report just released by CEPR. So today I am talking to Beatriz Veda Di Mauro. She is the president of CEPR. She's a professor here at the Institute, and she's one of the editors of the report. Beatriz, good to see you again.
Great to see you, Tim.
Now, Beatriz, it's COP season, and whenever COP is coming up, we are all hoping for one of those big global commitments and agreement from all countries to work together. We had one in Paris, but that's 10 years ago now. Is this sort of thing off the table?
Well, we are 10 years on, and a lot of things have changed. Not many for the better. You know, I said yesterday at the introduction of this type, where do we stand going into this COP season? The carbon budget implied in the Paris report is almost gone, meaning that 1.5 is almost gone. The US is gone from the Paris Agreement, but more generally actually also hostile against multilateral agreements. And ESG is largely gone. It is a word that at a parallel conference that we were holding here with the private financial sector is hardly mentioned anymore, or is in the process of being very, very actively rebranded along lines like E stands for efficiency and S for security and G for growth. That's not exactly what is the idea of somehow internalizing externalities or funding global commons. So there is a lot that has changed in the last 10 years. Now, here is the positive news. This is the first time there's going to be a COP in the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
That has some complications because there is actually deforestation happening in order to make it possible. But the focus on forests, on nature, the focus on combining carbon and carbon budgets going forward with the need to restore nature and to conserve nature, that is uniquely large this year. And the Brazilian government is making very large efforts to make this one of the success points of this COP.
But if we cannot get global cooperation to achieve these goals, what's plan B?
The plan B, including of the Brazilian government, is to build coalitions of the willing, or, you know, like-minded, as they are also sometimes called. The title of our report here is Global Action Without Global Governance. Is that possible? Yes, it is possible when you have an interest in collaborating. And the question is not new. When do countries get together to decide things that are in their common interest as a group and meet the participation constraint? That is the question that needs to be answered positively in order to build a coalition of willing that works. And we have different proposals of how to do that. I'll explain that in a minute, I think.
Yes, but Beatriz, if you have these coalitions and they exclude some of the largest economies, of course, the US, can they achieve anything meaningful?
Oh, yes. Well, it's very important to remind ourselves of where the emissions are in the world, where the future of climate and nature is. It's no longer in the advanced countries. 2/3 of all emissions already now are in emerging markets and developing countries. That's the starting point of this report, in fact. So that is what we need to solve. Of course, also very much in terms of biodiversity, in terms of being the custodians of natural capital, it's again in emerging markets and lower income countries. And the US itself, although a big emitter in per capita terms, is not such a big emitter on the global scale. It's the second largest, yes, but by far the largest, with one third of all emissions, is China now.
Mm-hmm.
And the other third is in other emerging markets. And the problem is that that is where the biggest growth is and where there is the biggest potential growth. Because a lot of these countries are still poor. They have a right and a need to grow. And the question will be, how do they grow? Do they grow brown or green?
And for them to grow green, we need to funnel more investment for the climate transition to emerging markets, developing economies. Can these coalitions of the willing do that, unlock
right,
that capital?
Right. That's one of the pillars. So you do need an incentive mechanism, right?
Uh-huh.
So one of the pillars around the funding and financing of the decarbonization of the power sector, that's one of our pillars in the Paris report. Another one is carbon taxation, or carbon pricing more generally, is also a very important mechanism. That's what, economists recommended for the longest time.
Uh-huh,
it's still
yes.
true, right? It's still true that it is the mechanism that will get you there fastest. Now, that's around carbon pricing is the first pillar. And now people will wonder, who want to do carbon pricing? There is a very large free rider problem. It's great if, the European Union brings down their carbon emissions through carbon pricing, but then if the others don't, then at the global scale, that is not going to be a big impact. And therefore, the incentives of the European Union also are not so large. So we do need collective action. The pillar one is organized around the incentive mechanism of the CBAM, Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism,
mm-hmm.
which the European Union is putting into place, has actually already put into place. It's just becoming more striking as we speak. And that is an incentive mechanism that has already led to carbon pricing in many large trading partners, include China. I'm not saying that CBAM is the only reason, but it is an incentive mechanism around which the coalition can be built. And that's one of the proposals.
We covered the previous Paris report in May 2024. It was called Europe's Economic Security, and it asked where Europe's economy is vulnerable. We spoke to Jean Pisani-Ferry of Bruegel and the Peterson Institute about those risks and what Europe could do to manage them. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts to listen to this episode and all our others as well.
Now, explain this to me. So we have this idea of carbon clubs. Bill mm-hmm. Nordhaus, I think, came up mm-hmm. with this a while ago. What is a carbon club?
Generally speaking, it is the idea that we have a group of countries
mm-hmm.
that takes action and also through their action at the border, incentivize others to join that club because there is a benefit of being inside. So let's take the carbon border adjustment mechanism again. How does it work? Well, why is the EU doing that in the first place? It's because increasingly the EU is charging for its emissions. Companies have to pay, and they're not just getting them for free, grandfathered as in the past. So then the emissions are being actually, polluter is paying in the EU. Now, the problem is the imports are not paying that. And that is why at the border, you put in place this adjustment mechanism to level the playing field again. And now, by doing that, if the other country also has a carbon pricing mechanism, then the product comes in free. So the incentive is the European market, which is access to the European market, or put differently, this is actually free trade in that sense, right? That is a big incentive in order to access that. And the other big incentive is countries are looking at this and saying, well, why should my companies pay at the border rather than me keeping the taxation of that carbon myself?
Mm-hmm.
So you see, this is an incentive compatible mechanism to increase carbon taxation, or has already led to the spread of carbon pricing mechanisms across the world. Now, there is a problem, and I'll tell you in a moment.
There's always a problem. There's always a problem on this. You have this carbon club. How do you join it? What do you have to do to join it?
you have to have a carbon pricing. And that is then the question, do you have to have a carbon price at the level of the EU, which yes. now is somewhere around 60 to has already been 80 euros per ton. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty steep carbon price in Europe.
A lot of countries have a lower carbon price.
Most countries have a lower carbon price if they have implemented one. Some of them have a very, very low carbon price.
Yes.
And now the question is, the proposal is, we should think of having, as the EU, tiered carbon pricing. One example could be that there is a 25 and 50, right? There are different categories of countries. Now, from the point of view of the climate, that's not ideal, right? Mm-hmm. Because from the point of view of the climate, ideally, we all have a global carbon price at the same level, and it is actually as high as the social cost of carbon. But that's not the world in which we are. So the idea of having a lower carbon price that would you would be able to join the club, but there would have to be some kind of convergence, right? That would have to be
have to be some pressure to raise your carbon
there
price
has to
over
be some
time.
Kind
otherwise,
of, right.
yeah, otherwise, it's not really a club, is it?
Well, it can still be a club with different entrance fees, but the problem is what the club is trying to achieve yeah. is reducing emissions at the global level through this mechanism. So this is the pricing side, right? So that's pillar one. And then there is pillar two, which is the financing side.
Yes. So you could have finance clubs as well, these finance coalitions right. of the willing. Right. How do they work to unlock finance?
If we only had one instrument, it would have to be an extremely high carbon price. We will need several instruments. We will also need some way of subsidizing or helping countries to decarbonize, and I'm talking here about the global south, I'm talking about emerging markets and developing countries, to do two things. One is retire dirty energy production early. If they are producing energy with coal, some of these plants should be retired before their lifespan is up. Mm-hmm. And they have to be able to fund their growth with clean energy. And the technology, fortunately, now is there. I mean, everybody knows by now, I think, that solar has become very cheap and that new installations in countries with a lot of sun, in most cases, will be economically and financially yeah. profitable. Therefore, there is no need to subsidize it, but there may be high capital costs in lower income countries. You know, they have higher spreads. And so there is a reason to provide guarantees. In some places, there may also have to be help with the technology itself. The installation and the capital costs initially are the problem, and not afterwards. Afterwards, it is a profitable proposition. So there again, the question is who can pay, in whose interest it is, and there the question is, how large does a coalition of the advanced countries have to be, who has to be included in order to make this in their interest mm-hmm. to decarbonize the rest of the world? Why is it in their interest? Because the damages are increasingly visible and higher as we speak. You know, if the rest of the world just keeps driving up the temperatures, apart from the fact how this is impacting nature and oceans and is leading us possibly closer to tipping points, it is in our interest. Okay. Now, the question is, who is we?
Yeah, who is we, and how many we's do we have?
How many we's do we need? Yes, yeah. Yes. I mean, the good news is that between Europe and China, you already have almost enough we's. we don't have to have the US, which is obviously not something we can count on right now. Mm-hmm. There is not such a large number of we's that you need in order to have a strong enough incentive to pay for the cost of the transition of the energy sector and decarbonize the world. Right? This is not a small proposal.
Yeah, these are big sums, and this is risky investment if it is not properly governed.
Yes.
Now, I could see why a lot of low-income countries would want access to these funds. What do they have to commit to, and what sort of monitoring do we have to put in place?
Yes, this of course would be a conditional type of funding. And there are already experiences of this type just for the club of countries gets together and tells and offers money for South Africa or Indonesia to retire coal early. Yeah, this is a more comprehensive proposal because it also includes the funding of the renewable pipeline in order to still be able to procure the energy. In order to make that work, what could be a way to do this is to have some kind of international climate fund institution, which doesn't need to be a new international institution with paid in capital, etc. It is the, but it would need to be the coalition of the willing would have to be able to manage that. They wouldn't have to pre-fund it, but it would be more on a contractual basis. When countries agree to do this kind of decarbonization, they also get the subsidies to do so.
I see. So when projects are agreed, there is a pull on funding to be able to then...
And of course, conditional in the sense that you that you have some monitoring capacity, and so that is probably not the biggest feasibility constraint. The problem is still coming up with the funds. Although it is in the interest collectively of the of a group of advanced countries, you still need the leadership of these advanced countries to sort of realize that it's in their interest.
Now, we've also been talking about nature restoration at this conference. Can you use the same logic to apply that to protecting nature?
Yes, I am actually, and this is something that is not in the report yet. Let me, you know, be very clear about this. But it's one thing we are thinking about, how to think about the institutional dimension of this funding, or what does you need for to make the different pillars work. The last pillar is one way of thinking about is we are going to overshoot. It's almost inevitable, the 1.5. And therefore, there will be a need in the future to reduce CO2 from the atmosphere. Now, there are two ways of doing that, technology. And let me say that very clearly, direct air capture right now is 0.004 million gigatons. That is almost a rounding error. It is just not there. It needs to scale enormously to get to the amounts that we would need on a permanent basis, because we won't be able to not every industry can be decarbonized. We will still have emissions. We need to take out on a permanent basis carbon from the atmosphere, and we need to manage the overshoot. This needs negative emissions, and I've already said technology needs a huge boost. So there is a question, how can that be done? And in fact, the world has a technology. The planet has developed it over millions of years. And in fact, it's the reason why you and I are sitting here right now. It's the reason why we have an atmosphere which has a lot of oxygen in it. It's because these plants over there, they are fixing carbon and releasing oxygen, at least during the day.
Yeah.
But they are doing this on a massive scale everywhere. Whenever you have a piece of land that is not constructed on, something will come up and will absorb and fix carbon from the atmosphere. Natural solutions is the how we're using photosynthesis as a way to extract carbon from the atmosphere.
But we've had projects to try and preserve the environment, reforestation in a piecemeal sort of way.
Correct.
You're talking about creating a market mechanism that will be more effective, because of course that has suffered from all sorts of credibility problems.
Well, the voluntary carbon market, which has been the anchor for also attaching on nature and biodiversity benefits, is essentially broken. And the attempts to get it back up with through further monitoring, further precise measurement, etc., are difficult. I'm not saying they're completely doomed, but they are increasing the amount of transaction costs. Mm-hmm. And what you have there is a private, you know, little private developers that are offering their wares on many platforms with tons of intermediaries. And on the other side, you have companies that are well, we're trying to offset. I don't know if they're still doing it in the future going forward. Yes, one of our important proposals of this report is, and it's pillar four, is how to redesign a market for nature shares that would be able to fund restoration of nature in, especially in the global south, but also to a certain extent conservation. And the concept of moving from something transactional, which is a credit. I'll buy a ton from you this year and next year I buy a ton from another. But you know what? Your ton may no longer be there tomorrow because there was a wildfire. Mm-hmm. Now, a nature share has the benefit, or more generally, a share, a stock, has a forward-looking perspective always in it. The idea is nature shares are a solution that could scale and could deliver this funding that is needed. But before, you know, we are too excited about extracting carbon from the atmosphere and saving nature, which is absolutely necessary, we should also make sure that we stop destroying as much as humans.
If you have this market mechanism and you want people to buy shares, then that has to be credible. We have to know that the shares are meaningful and that the restoration is being properly measured, because, for example, pension funds are very conservative about what they invest in. How do you make sure that there is enough demand?
Now, in the report, our proposal is that one could use asset managers, portfolios. At the level of portfolio, there could be a requirement that they have to be carbon neutral and nature positive. And these kind of shares would then allow that, because you have other shares which are not, and then you basically can rebalance that. So that's one proposal. To be honest, and again, this is not in the report, I've become a bit more radical. I do think that every child is born with a nature debt and with a climate debt these days. Wouldn't it be a good idea that every child sort of, you know, has to buy, as a parents that would be buying, in fact, some nature shares, but, you know, those are then to be kept, and there were, and this market, the demand could also, and we can limit it also to other advanced countries to start with. But in principle, you know, if you think about the logic, we humans, everybody on this planet already comes to this planet with a nature debt that could be also rebalanced.
So, Beatrice, coalitions of the willing, they mean that people have to be inspired to join them. Who's going to lead this? Who's going to form these coalitions?
Yes, obviously not the US, no. but the EU, I mean, the commitment at the level of at the top of the EU, I am absolutely certain, is still intact, and the will to drive this forward, I mean, not only within the EU, decarbonize the EU is great, but we are now about 8% of all emissions. So finding ways to collaborate in order to make sure that the rest of the world also comes along and has incentives to come along. I see the EU very much in the driver's seat. And the second big, and that's the good news, is China is much further than that they typically know on their own path. And now the question will be, how much can China be incentivized to also help decarbonize the rest of the world? They have the technology, at least.
And returning to the fact that we're just coming into COP season, by definition, the willing will all be there at COP30, and they will be gathered together. Can we make progress to creating these coalitions at COP30? And instead of having a big announcement, hoping that everyone's involved, have some smaller but significant announcements that really move the needle?
Yes, I mean, these two governance systems are not the same. And in fact, we have one chapter in the report by Laurence Dubiana, you know, the architect of the Paris Agreement. And she also says we need coalitions of ambition, right? Countries that want to go further. But this does not mean that we should completely abandon the COP process, which has these nationally determined contributions as anchors. At the moment, I would say, yes, we just should try, you know, both. The coalitions will be a subset, and no, they will not be announced at Belém.
Well, we hope for some progress anyway. Beatrice, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
To find out more, I'd recommend that you read that report, but I put aside an afternoon for it. It's 300 pages long. The title is Paris Report 3, Global Action Without Global Governance, Building Coalitions for Climate Transition and Nature Restoration. The editors are Jean Pisani-Ferry, Beatrice Veda Di Mauro, and Jeremin Zettelmeyer. It was created by CPR in collaboration with Bruegel. And of course, it is a free download from cepr.org.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, has the green transition missed its golden moment?